So it's very important to have a look at, is this really a me, and am I really owning this? So you can see that the contemplation and the mindfulness of the body are geared towards gaining insight. And insight means that we have a different understanding and a different reaction to ourselves. When we have learned to have a different reaction to ourselves, then we know we have made use of insight. I often compare insight to a foreign language which we can learn. But if you don't use it, it goes to the back of the mind. And somebody comes along and speaks French, and you recognize the fact that you actually do know the language, but you don't understand the word they're saying, or you understand every tenth word they're saying, and you can't really answer back because you haven't practiced it. So we need to practice the language, we need to practice the insight. Any insight that comes to us, we need to use it in daily life again and again and again, so that it becomes not a foreign language, but our mother tongue. And only then do we know it. So when we have this, any kind of insight, it should not be accepted and then laid aside. It needs to be part and parcel of our daily living. That's very important. Sometimes people have an insight during meditation, and they come out of meditation and have forgotten it. That's not uncommon. If you can be very concentrated, it's not uncommon to forget it. If it is a really important insight that comes during meditation, open your eyes and write it down. Try not to bother other people by finding the right page and rustling around with the paper and scratching with the pen, but do it nicely and quietly, but do write it down. Or, it may not be necessary. What you can do is you can actually make that insight totally clear to yourself and stay with it during the rest of the meditation and see, to investigate how that insight would change your reaction in certain given situations which you can make up at that time. And then you can't forget it when you come out of meditation, you know it. Sometimes that happens, that your insight arises, and you go on with the concentrated meditation, and at the end of it, you know, there was something, but I can't remember. So it was, again, like learning a foreign language, hearing the word, forgetting it immediately. It can be resurrected, but it's painful. It takes time. So either one of these two. Sometimes the paper rustling and pen scratching cannot be avoided, then it's better to stay with the inside and look at imaginary situations, how that kind of insight would change one's own reaction. And this is actually what insight does. It changes our reactions. Changes our reactions to the point where we can rely on them. We can rely on the reaction that it's going to be equanimous, it's going to be easy, it's going to be self-confident, it's going to be secure. That's really what insight does. And when you have those kind of inner feelings, it's much easier to be loving and helpful. It makes it much, much easier. Now, the unity consciousness which you get out of the element meditative contemplation also helps to have loving kindness and compassion for others, because you don't see them as others. So the unity consciousness is a very important aspect of this mindfulness of the body. The mindfulness of the body also extends to the parts of the body. And we will do a contemplation on that, but I'll just mention the parts of the body first. I'm not going to give a list of them. But the Buddha compared this to a cart that has wheels and axle and floorboards and sides. And as you look at them, and they're not being put together, you just see the wheels and the axle and the floorboards and the sides of the cart. But once you put these together, those bits and pieces, you call it cart. And the same with the human body. It consists of all bits and pieces. And once they're put together, we call it me. For no good reason whatsoever. Now, there are lots of bits and pieces which we have inside of us that can be taken out and we can still live. For instance, the gallbladder. We can be taken out. One can even live with one kidney. Maybe not perfectly, but one can. So let's say that we have a gallbladder taken out and it's now sitting in formaldehyde in a little glass jar in the hospital. Is that me? Well, it certainly was when it was still in there. But when it's sitting in the glass jar, it's not called me, is it? It's just a messy piece of equipment that we carry around with us. Anything like that. There are other bits and pieces that we can do without. So when there's, for instance, our teeth, well, we get the first lot and then we get the second lot. But the third lot we have to buy. So, and in order to buy a third lot, people very often have all of them taken out. So they're all taken out and they're all at the dentist now. Well, are they called me? But when you have them, they're my teeth. They're mine. And then they're taken out and they're no longer useful. So you can stop the identification. That happens when one becomes nun or monk. And that it don't hit out your teeth or anything, but they cut off your hair, and somebody does that for you, you know, and shaves it off. And as they shave it, they give you a bunch of it to hold in your hand and look at it and inquire whether that's me. Because while you were still having it, obviously it's my hair. I own it. It's mine. And now it's off. Now it's in my hand. What is it? It's just ready for the waste basket, that's all. Or the compost heap, wherever you want to put it. It's not mine. So this is, I mean, I don't mean to say by that this particular 10-minute contemplation is going to get these novices enlightened, but you can see the veracity of it. I mean, that's the way it is. While you're carrying it around, it's all mine. It belongs to me. I own it. In fact, it is me. And cut it off, throw it away, and it's no longer anything. It's just rubbish. This is a very important aspect of finding out about this fallacy of me and mine of the body. And you can actually play that game by yourself. You can snip off a bit of hair. I mean, everybody's got enough of that to snip off a little bit. Hold it in your hand and look at it and say, mine? Why should that be mine? It's nothing. It's absolutely nothing. So when one does it oneself, one gets a better idea of it. Becoming more removed from that identification system with the body. Obviously, we have to eventually become removed from the identification system with the mind and the observer, but we start with something, so we start with the body. And the Buddha also not only recommended that because it's such a very strong identification, but also because he said it's easier because we can touch the body, we can see the body, we can see that this hair isn't mine once it's cut off, we can see that these teeth aren't mine once they're gone, whereas with the mind and the observer it's more difficult. But we need to make a start somewhere, so the important thing is with the body. Watching what one does with the body, the mindfulness, and then gaining these kinds of insights, because you can't, nobody is able to watch their movements all day long. We can do it for some time, but you can't do it all day long. So then you revert to these kind of investigations. You know, who is telling the body to move? The mind's telling the body to move. And this body that I'm considering me, has it always been me like this? Or does it look different now? So you can have a very exact understanding of the fact that it's changing all the time because it doesn't look the same way it used to. If you have any old photos, you know it doesn't look the way it used to. Everybody has some old photos. And the mind, when they look at old photos, very often says, oh, I looked much better then. Or, gee, I've grown old. Or, that's a good photo of me, I look very nice there. Or vice versa, I'd look terrible. It's a total identification system with the house we live in, which we call me and mine. So when we do, when we are mindful of the body and the mind wanders off from being mindful of the movements, put it on the fact whether this is really me or whether this is really mine. And use all these possibilities, which are all suggestions, and use them and see whether you can see the truth of this, that this is a mind-made idea which has no basis in fact. And this mind-made idea that we have creates all the problems that exist in the world. There are no problems other than this mind-made fact, that this is me and this is mine. I like to do this parts of the body contemplation with you. Quite a number of you know it already. That doesn't matter. We'll do it together and to get a recapitulation of it. And before we do, we could stand up and stretch your legs. No, I'm fine. I'm fine without it. Especially since I've just been talking about not wanting comfort. Yes. But I am really fine without it. we'll put our attention on the breath for just a few moments. And now we'll imagine that we have a zipper in front of our body, which goes from top of the head all the way down as far as we want it to go, particularly the trunk. All the way down the trunk of the body. And then we open up with that zipper. We can open up the trunk of the body and also the head. And we start taking out all the bits and pieces that we can find inside. And as we do that, we become aware of how they feel when we touch them, and also if we have any idea what they look like. And we pile them up neatly in front of us. Stomach, kidneys, lungs, gallbladder, intestines, heart, ribs, eyes, teeth, anything we can think of. And if we take all these bits and pieces out, we see that the skin is shrinking a bit. Take out some fat, put it in front of us, and it's shrinking a bit more. Take out some blood. And if we think we have found most of the bits and pieces that are inside of us, we then take out the bones and we nicely and neatly pile them up in front of us. Small ones and medium-sized ones and large ones. We take a good look at them. See what they look like. How they feel. And now the skin really collapses. Nothing to hold it up now. And now we take a good look at this pile of bones that we have in front of us and the pile of intestines and liver and kidney and heart and gallbladder and blood and fat. look at this pile, those two piles, and have a look to see where the me is in that. Can you find me in any of these parts? Or would you rather that there wasn't a me in those parts? Because they're not especially beautiful. They're liable to destruction. To decay and to disease. Look at them again. Would it be preferable not to have a me amongst all those parts? Would it be preferable not to be the owner, but just to look at them quite objectively as a manifestation of wanting to be, a manifestation of nature? There's no need to reject these bits and pieces. There's only a need to recognize them for what they are. Now you might take a few pieces which you realize and know that are not essential for life and put them aside. And now you can start putting the bones back inside. Take the right bone and put it in its right place, as much as you can find the right place. And see how the skin gets a little more expanded again. And now take all the other bits and pieces and get the feel, how they feel when you touch them, if you can. And also, if you can visualize what they might look like and try to put them in the right places as much as you know where the right places are. Having put the backbone back in, the skin is quite straight up and down again, and you find room to put all the inside pieces in. And put all the teeth back in, and the eyes, and the tongue, the brain. And the blood. And the fat. And when you have finished putting all the pieces back inside, have a look at those that you left out because you realize you don't need them to be alive. And then zip the trunk and the face up again. Close it up. And now investigate whether you have a sense of relief that you're back together again, or whether there's no feeling of otherness from having the parts separate or the parts within. Mainly, do you feel relieved because you're in one piece again? And if so, ask yourself why. Now have another look to investigate why it is not possible to find a me when you take the bits and pieces apart, and why it is me when they are together. what's the essential difference? Why is there a me when the bits and pieces are held together with the skin? Now you see, we have many possibilities of getting at the truth. We can feel ourselves the same as a cloud or a tree, which is quite pleasant. But we can also take out the liver and the gallbladder and the heart and the lungs, which is not that pleasant. But it's all one and the same. And I would like to suggest to use these, also this contemplation, because it is an enormous help in realizing that there's nothing within this body that ever says me. Nothing. Nothing whatsoever. They're all bits and pieces. And actually, in the medical profession, one should imagine that one would find a number of enlightened people, because they can see these things, especially if they're surgeons. You know, they take out bits and pieces and there's nobody there. But that's not the case, not at all. In fact, they identify even more with the body. I had a very interesting experience that way. Well, I didn't have it, the doctor had it. In one of these operations that I had, there seemed to be a little tumor right up here, which turned out to be nothing. It wasn't anything at all. But anyway, there are two doctors. One is the surgeon and one is his assistant. And the assistant got very friendly with me already the first time I was there, because he used to go to the same school that my granddaughter is going to in San Diego, and he loves detective stories, and I do, and he speaks English better than German, and so we had a lot of common interests, so we were very friendly. And he was supposed to assist the surgeon. And apparently, I mean, I know nothing about it. I mean, I was completely out of it. Apparently, an awful lot of blood came out of here, because it was very near to one of the main arteries. And this assistant doctor, who's been a doctor for 30 years, mind you, got nauseated, got scared, and couldn't carry on helping the surgeon. And he actually told me this. And the surgeon, of course, made fun of him, you know, that he got that way. But that was because he got to know me and saw me as this body. I was this person. And there was this blood coming out, and he was afraid that the surgeon had hit one of the main arteries, which he hadn't at all. I mean, I'm here to prove it. So... But you can see that even when you do these things, take bits and pieces out of people, you still don't get it if you haven't got the Buddha to tell you what it's all about. So that was quite an interesting phenomena for me to hear that. And the surgeon really made fun of her, because the surgeon is one step higher than he is. He's a chief doctor in that section, and he's the second after him. So it was quite interesting. So I'd like you to do this now. If you have questions about the whole matter, or anything else for that matter, this is the time to voice them. Ah, you've got little bits of paper.
Just about that contemplation, right? If I do that, I won't find my mind either when I take everything out. And the key is my mind creation. Right?
Sorry, say that again?
The body being me is my mind's creation.
Right.
In the first place.
Mm-hmm.
I just get impatient with doing that because I think, well, I'm not going to find my mind either by taking these things out of my body. But it's creating the me.
Right. But don't get impatient. We'll get to the mind. We want to first get it quite clear that the body isn't me. Okay? And we'll get to the mind, no doubt about it. But, step by step. And yes, this is a useful way for not identifying with the body. Okay? Could you please speak some more about how we need to have a blueprint or map for our own enlightenment? Does it mean remembering the possibility of enlightenment and therefore the importance of practice, or is it a more practical plan than this? Well, that's not impractical, what you're saying there, that one remembers the possibility of enlightenment, that's all right. But I meant more than that, and the importance of practice, sure, that's fine. But I meant more than that. I meant more like if some disquiet comes up, some anxiety, some dislike, some worry, anything like that, at that moment to go inside and see, well, why is it coming up? It can only be coming up because I am worried. I am not quiet. I am not at ease. So if I wasn't there, none of this would happen. Now, that's only a manner of talking to oneself. But you can at the same time try to imagine that this I wasn't there. And possibly drop the worry for a moment. It's a way of imagining that one has actually let go of this delusion. An imagination of letting go of the delusion. By no means thinking, now I've imagined it, now I'm enlightened. That would be utter nonsense. But to imagine, I have let go of this, and that worry wouldn't be there. Of course, the worry comes back, because one hasn't let go yet. Then another thing one can do is, how do I let go? And that would be to try and find out what one really is stuck on, what one really wants to keep. One's own importance, one's own status, one's hopes for the future, one's what do I want to keep? And to look at that and see, can I let go of it? That really would make some difference. And we'll talk more about this, of course, every day. if someone attains enlightenment during a human life and then contracts a disease like dementia, which deteriorates the mind's capacities, do they remain an enlightened being or do they return to samsara? No. If somebody's enlightened, they're enlightened. And that's it. How would you contract dementia? I mean, how would you contract this? Is that a physical matter? Or? It's physical. Yes, it's still enlightened. We have an example of that, Ajahn Chah. I mean, he didn't have dementia, he had water on the brain and he had an operation and it made it worse instead of better. And he was 10 years alive without being able to speak and do anything. But if he was enlightened, which I have no knowledge whether he was or wasn't, he was enlightened, that's it. You know, whether he can speak or do anything, it has nothing to do with it. Mind's enlightened. What happens to the mind at the time of death? We will talk about this as we get to the mind. We are in the body right now. When the Buddha became enlightened, his initial decision was not to teach. Yes, I can fully understand that, you know. No problem with that at all. He said teaching would be vexatious for him. The Buddha was very much against, you mean proselytizing with evangelism? Yeah, proselytizing. Teaching Buddhism is said to create good karma, but is also considered to be an obstruction to the development of serenity concentration. Mm-hmm. Could you please say something about the Buddhist attitude towards teaching Buddhism? Well, I don't know what the Buddhist attitude is towards teaching Buddhism. I can only tell you what the Buddha's attitude is. The Buddha's attitude was this. First of all, he decided to teach. That was one thing. But the second thing is that in one of his suttas, he said that if you find an enlightened person, then take that person as your teacher. If you can't find an enlightened one, try to find a non-returner. Can't find a non-returner, take a once-returner. Can't find a once-returner, take a stream-entra. Can't find a stream-entra, find one that knows all the suttas and can teach all the suttas. If you can't find one that knows all the suttas, then find one that knows a lot of suttas and can teach you that. And if you can't find one that knows a lot of suttas, then find one that knows one sutta and can teach you that. So that was his idea about teaching. He said that teaching would be a vexation for him because his whole doctrine is so contrary to anything that anybody was teaching and anybody would be living that nobody could understand it. And then he had another look with his clairvoyance, one should think, and saw that there were a few people with little dust in their eyes. And so out of compassion for those few people that had little dust in their inner eye, he started teaching. Certainly he's against proselytizing. No missionary work. Missionary work is when you try to convince people who don't want to know anything about you. So Buddhist teachers, generally, as far as I know, only go where they're invited to go. They never go anywhere where people don't even want to know about it. You know, so this is always like that. Buddhist teaching is creating good karma.